Your theme, B, is a fascinating one. It more than captivates the attention and rigorously stimulates the imagination. B, it is everything to everyone all the time, yet poses a formidable challenge to be harnessed and presented in a meaningful way in 18 to 20 minutes in a graduation address. The word B is most often coupled with to. We like to talk about the infinitive and so forth, but it is often used in the passive sense, the passive form. You, however, use the action verb form, and the implications are great. It has to do with conscious identity, with active being. Your chosen biblical text, Micah 6:8, clearly emphasizes the active form of be. Yesterday, your classmate Luke shared his story of loss of identity and how he has struggled to recapture his own essence, his being. On a humorous note, however, there is a report that the actor Peter Sellers played so many movie roles that he sometimes would forget his own identity. When asked one day by a fan, "Are you Peter Sellers?" he answered briskly, "Not today," and moved on. Did he just brush that fan off? Was he suffering from amnesia like Luke? Was he suffering from something even more serious? The illusion of life he created in his acting. In the book entitled The Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, the author examines the illusion of literacy, the illusion of love, the illusion of wisdom, the illusion of happiness, and the illusion of society that characterize life today. Is this what we have become? Is this our state of being? Is it true that all the world's a stage and we, all the people, merely players? Mulholland declares that we all have deeply ingrained perceptual frameworks that shape our lives in the world, structures of habit, attitude, perspective, relational dynamics, and response mechanisms. These, he says, shape our understanding of God, our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of others. In our daily lives, the Micah 6:8 realm, that every day walking around life, our perceptual frameworks shape our interactions in all three of these relational realms of life. These frameworks, our worldview, our ideologies, condition the way we respond and react to life situations. Jesus was working on shaping these three in the Beatitudes, the Beatitudes. Beatitudes. Of course, in this context, one is a, whether you are a student of Shakespeare or not, one's thoughts surely go to the famous to be or not to be soliloquy from the play Hamlet. Soliloquy, dramatic monologue or declamation. The theatrical soliloquy was, and even now, is often used to reveal the innermost thoughts of a character to public view. It is an act of baring the soul. Hamlet says, "To be or not to be, this is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to be or not to be." Hamlet's soliloquy has become a focus of many analytical exercises. For example, one analysis characterizes this passage as a deliberation on the conflict between reason and passion. Another portrays the soliloquy as universal in perspective, that is, as the dilemma applied to the universal man or woman, sort of everything to everyone, the all-in-all decision. This writer asserts also that Hamlet, no less than Augustine, is working out a theorem, which is of general application, based on a fundamental question, perhaps the fundamental question concerning human life, the desirability of having it all. The question, to be or not to be, is that which comes at the juncture of freedom and bondage for every human being. For you see, the only real freedom we have is the freedom of choice, to be or not to be. A more contemporary writer, Ross Douthat, appears to address the same issues in his 2005 book, in which he reports in great detail on his transformation in his undergraduate experience at Harvard University. He titled his work, Privilege, Harvard and the Education of the Ruling Class. Privilege, honor to self, pleasure, source of pride, license. The theme of this post-graduation address, privilege, has both noun and verb form. Yet the discourse makes clear that in the Harvard educational process, privilege is an action verb. The title reveals the content, as with Hamlet, an analysis of having it all. The content depicts Harvard as a culture of privilege, of ambition and entitlement, as a stepping stone to high salaries and coveted social networks, the very best in intellectual, human, and social capital, the act of privileging. On his graduation day and in his later reflections, Douthat says in what could be regarded as his definitive soliloquy, "The pull of privilege is too strong. My efforts to escape it, too weak, too half-hearted." He says, "I seek the approval of men more than the favor of God." These, his innermost thoughts, now made public, reveal who he has become. You see, Ross Douthat says he entered college seeking an education for the purpose of changing the world, of making a difference, with the idealistic aim of making the world a better place, of advocating for all people, those in need and distress. Then, when faced with the fundamental question, to be or not to be, he responded in the negative. He chose not to be. Harvard, as I recalled, held its 360th commencement this past May. According to one of its announcements, it says that this was the public celebration of thousands of personal success stories and a launching into brilliant futures, the final act of privileging. Harvard has produced 8 presidents of the United States, including the current president. Its faculties have produced more than 40 Nobel laureates, including the current U.S. president. Yes, these are they who know success as measured by the world standards. Let's quickly take an analytical look at success and see how it applies. The one absolutely stunning success among the universally familiar apostles was Judas, by worldly standards. The one thoroughly groveling failure, Dr. Oliver, was Peter, by worldly standards. Judas was successful both financially and politically and was well connected. He was a man of ambition and entitlement, a privileged man. He cleverly arranged to control the funds of the apostolic team. He skillfully manipulated the political forces of the day to accomplish his goals. On the other hand, Peter, poor, pathetic Peter, was crude, crass, an impulsive failure. He was socially unskilled, brash, and lacked true courage. He could not manage anything or lead anyone, for he could not control his own tongue or predict his own behavior in any given situation. He just did not think before he acted. Yet, Peter demonstrated what one world leader learned. Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue, the courage to be, that counts. Time has revealed and has reversed its judgments on these two men. Now, even by worldly standards, Judas is a villain and Peter is a saint. It all has to do with the ultimate choice, to be or not to be. You would think that this would be a lesson learned. However, the world and often the church continue to chase after the Judas successes, financial wealth, and political power. The paradox is that we've learned how to make a living, but not how to make a life. We don't know what and how to be. Many who graduate this year will define themselves by what they do in search of worldly fame and fortune, and will judge themselves and others by the degree to which they achieve fame and accumulate fortune through what they do. Augustine once warned that we should not seek to be successful, but rather should seek to be people of value. This implies relationship. True success is using your educational attainments, power, position, connections, all your gifts, talents, and resources to make a positive difference in the world. It requires remembering who you are and also remembering whose you are. It will require a position, a positive response every day of your life in the definitive question, to be or not to be. You have an education now with the knowledge and skills to go out into the world and make your mark. You must accept neither the world's definition of success nor its acquiescence to evil. You must make a difference for good. You must not only make but be the sacrifice that aims to make the world a better place. For a world that is spinning out of control, you must be stability. For societies terrorized by violence and strife, you must be peace and harmony. For communities imprisoned by dogma, you must be change. For people shackled by injustice, you must be integrity. For the dislocated and disillusioned, you must be hope. For the disenfranchised and silenced, you must be voice. For those lost in sinful darkness, you must be a light of deliverance. For you see, knowledge becomes relevant only when it is translated into action. Action that is the public expression of your inner being. For true success, knowledge must become wise action. Theory must become correct practice. And theology must become life. This is the lesson of your Micah 6:8. The Message version of your verse says this: but he's already made it plain how to live, what to do, what God is looking for in men and women. It's quite simple. Do what is fair and just to your neighbor. Be compassionate and loyal in your love. And don't take yourself too seriously, as was read earlier. Take God seriously. This conclusion comes after a most interesting soliloquy. The people of God who had gone astray again, each in his or her own voice, now sought God in soliloquous fashion in the verses that precede your verse. They revealed their inner longings to restore their relationship with God. Each one speaks for him or herself. How can I stand before God? What shall I do? With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? They're trying, but are they asking the wrong questions? They're confused, thinking to purchase or barter with God for relationship. Notice the price grows progressively higher as you read those first verses of Micah 6. The customs expressed in this soliloquy seem to be based on the idea that the value heaven places upon an offering is calculated according to its cost. In spite of their declared relationship with God, the influence of the heathenism prevailed in their minds. The questions raised here, the innermost thoughts made public, as with Hamlet, demand a negative answer. They found, however, as all must find, that external religious practices or make-believe humility or role-play integrity cannot substitute for internal character and obedience. God did not want their substance, their material things, or religious rituals, but rather required their essence, their being, not alone their worship, but their will, their being, not alone their service, but their soul, their being. Romans 12, 1 and 2 make it clear that it is by the renewing of your mind that you come to be what God wants. It says, so here's what I want you to do in the message. God helping you, take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, and walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing you can do for him. Don't become so well-adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out. Readily recognize what he wants from you and quickly respond to it. Unlike the culture around you, always dragging you down to its level of immaturity, God brings the best out of you, develops well-formed maturity in you. Once we understand this, we allow God to break through human cultures and traditions, disrupt them, and call us to find our true identity, values, and purpose in life. Let us conclude with looking at Hamlet again. Hamlet's answer when he speaks of his own individual plight and gives vent to his personal feelings is most often negative. It is the choice of not to be. Yet, this negative answer is not the play's final answer. In the end, Hamlet comes to accept his purpose and the fact that guilt must be atoned for. The play finally offers you a hero who, in a world where good and evil inseparably mingle, is tempted to shun his lot in life, but then comes to embrace it, choosing finally to be. While your purpose in life is vastly different from Hamlet's, you also must come to grips with the same, with the inner parameters of who you are, and then choose to be. Now, as you depart Avondale, as you stand at the crossroads of freedom and bondage, the question is yours, and it is answered only by your action to choose. Isaiah 61, first three verses, call you to choose, to preach good tidings to the poor, to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to open the prison for those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to give them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, that the Lord may be glorified. The Lord may be glorified. This is what it looks like to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. So, class of 2011, which is it, to be or not to be? This is the question of whether you will suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To be or not to be, choose to be.